And then I sat, and pretty quickly it dissipated. And at some point, I even forgot where I was, sitting here. And suddenly, for some reason, I thought, well, where am I? And then I remembered I was here with you all. And then at one point, I remembered I was going to give a talk again. And then I could feel, and I was pretty sensitive that time, I could feel like this little nervousness kind of float up my stomach. And as it floated up, it kind of just melted away. And then I sat some more. And it happened once more, sitting here. This flutter of nervousness came up. And then, for me, it's kind of remarkable to come here and sit, because whatever's happening before I sit down, it's like a world away by the end of the 45 minutes. And it's completely, everything's completely new. And like, if I'm nervous before I'm going to give a talk, like, usually by the time I finish sitting 45 minutes, it's gone. For better or worse. So tonight I'm going to talk about fear. And I've also decided that, and maybe it's appropriate following up on fear, that this coming Wednesday, we have this old students class that often meets Wednesday afternoons from 4:30 to 6. I would like to do this coming Wednesday, a special kind of session on death and dying, kind of from a Theravadan Buddhist point of view, and doing some guided meditations around death and dying. And I would like to make that particular class available to anybody who's interested, not just the older students. If any of you here would like to learn a little bit more about death and dying from the perspective of the Buddhist tradition and do some exercises around it, you're welcome to come here on Wednesday, this Wednesday at 4:30. And yes. And I would like to know then approximately how many people would like to come, would think they might come. Keep your hands up for a moment, please. Okay. Because I would like to Xerox some things and bring them along to give to you. I think, as many of you know, the word vipassana, the Pali word for this practice that we do here, means literally something like clear seeing. And it's based on the practice of allowing ourselves to be present for things as they are, as they arise. And so there's no striving in this practice. It's not like we're trying to get someplace that we're not. It's not a goal-oriented practice. It's not a practice that involves changing who you are, but it's rather a practice of seeing clearly who you are and what's happening as it unfolds without our interference. So there's no striving, but even so, there is an unfolding in the sense of perhaps an ironing out of all the creases in our awareness, all the places our awareness gets hung up. And there's an unfolding, and opening up that happens in a beautiful way. And unfolding has different meanings. And one is just a natural progression, opening up of a certain sequence. But also in thinking about it, writing this note down, I thought of how we unfold, like, you know, like a napkin, or unfold a piece of paper, and then we kind of iron out the creases. And I think there's this kind of unfolding of awareness. All the corners and edges and crevices get ironed out, and the awareness becomes very smooth. In Zen Buddhism, this dedication to be present, which is very similar to our practice, is based on the idea that the present moment is perfect and complete just as it is, or that we, as we are Buddhas, that we are Buddhas, or we are the expressions of Buddhahood itself. And the practice, again, is not goal-oriented practice, but rather is a kind of acceptance practice that accepts the kind of innate perfection that's here already. In Vipassana, we shy away from holding views and opinions about what is actually happening. we simply are dedicated towards being present without having an overlay of, now you're a Buddha, or this is perfect, or this is not perfect. It's much more simple than, you know, it's simpler than what the Zen people do, in a sense. That's just what's happening. It's all you need to know. It doesn't matter if you're a Buddha or not. Just so as we do this, we meet, as we stay present for our reality, we meet the folds and creases of our life, those feelings, emotions, and attitudes that make being present difficult. And fundamentally, according to the Buddha's teachings, the folds and inhibitions and creases to our awareness all stem from our attachments, all come from attachments. And realizing the extent to which pain and suffering comes from attachment, it would be easy then to set up an ideal of non-attachment, of a state of being unattached, of non-clinging. And while non-attachment might be a good thing, and in some sense it's that non-goal goal of all this practice, in some sense it might be a good idea, especially in an ideal sense, it's very important not to establish our practice in idealism, not to practice idealistically when we do this practice. So rather than some kind of ideal, what we're trying to do is to be present for the actual. And it can be a big difference, and a very important difference. So rather than trying to be unattached or trying to be attached, what we're trying to do is trying to understand and realize what attachment and non-attachment is. We have to realize what attachments are, and only then can we realize true non-attachment. If you try to rush to be non-attached, you're going to live a life often of denial, of avoidance, and often a life that's not so interesting, actually is maybe kind of dead more than alive, if you set up an ideal of non-attachment. If we start with the view that we should not be attached to anything, then that very attachment to that view becomes a problem. So in Vipassana, we are seeking clear vision, and a level of trust and confidence that supports that clear vision. Just simply a clear vision of what's happening as it happens, without any philosophy or metaphysics or opinions about what's going on. Sometimes it's helpful to have a little bit of kind of opinions about it. It helps you to be present, and so you get teachings like we're already Buddha, or things are perfect just the way they are, or, you know. And that can be useful at times, but again, it's an opinion. And radically, it's a very radical practice we're practicing here. And it's a practice which doesn't rely on views and opinions, but is trying to see clearly what's happening. And I think it's very important to mention that in doing so, we are the only authority for what is happening, for our direct experience. There's no one outside of ourselves which can know what we're directly experiencing in the present. So we become our own authority. So in this line, I'd like to read a quote by Krishnamurti. It is not that you must be free from fear. The moment you try to free yourself from fear, you create a resistance against fear. Resistance in any form does not end fear. What is needed, rather than running away or controlling or suppressing or any other resistance, is understanding fear. That means watch it, learn about it, come directly into contact with it. We are to learn about fear, not how to escape from it, not how to resist it through courage, and so on. So our task is not to learn about non-attachment, not to learn about attachment. No, our task is not to learn about non-attachment, but to learn very well what attachment is. And in learning about what attachment is, then non-attachment will take care of itself in a beautiful way. And same thing with fear. So our task with fear is not to turn away from it or avoid it, but in a sense to embrace it, to really get to know it well. So even though maybe we're not supposed to have opinions and attitudes and views when we do this practice. I find that it's when working mindfully with fear or any other emotion or any aspect of our life, it is useful to take the attitude of a naturalist, to become a naturalist of our inner life. And I like, it's beautiful, the idea of a naturalist, because a naturalist is someone who goes into nature and tries not to interfere with nature, just simply watches it and treats everything kind of equally. The tiger that eats the deer is just, that's just nature, and the naturalist just watches it, just watches everything as if it's just kind of all equal, just is curious to find out what's going on, accepts everything as it is. So we are also products of nature. We are nature. And to separate ourselves, to be different from nature, in a sense, is a kind of an arrogance. So we just see ourselves as being nature. And it's our anger, our depressions, our fears, our happinesses, our joys, our pains, our pleasures. We want to respect them. We want to be present for them. We don't want to not experience all those things. But we can experience them as naturalists. And say, ah, there's that interesting phenomenon, depression. What's that about? So here's a human being who's depressed. Now, not only is this interesting for naturalists, but I can be a naturalist from the inside out. That's kind of unusual for a naturalist. You can actually kind of, so you could explore and find out. Isn't that fun? It's a very different attitude than saying, oh, why me? Not again. Sorry?
Question.
Yes.
I was thinking about allowing an intention last week, the tension between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that what you're saying implies a great deal of trust in some sort of process. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking also about that one has to make decisions about what one does with these states of being that one observes, whether they enter into them or not.
Right. So in the context of our sitting practice is a very unique place, because in sitting we can give ourselves unconditional permission to feel whatever's going on. And no decisions have to be made. And you're not going to get in trouble as long as you stay in this posture. So it's a wonderful place to experiment even. You know, what is it like to discover who you are? And let it, whatever bubbles up, bubble up. So we also do this practice outside of sitting. And then we have to make some decisions. And just what you said, I mean, what you said was fine. One of the things we're trying to learn in this practice is to respond rather than react. So if we can see clearly what's going on, we can own up and see our anger, then we don't have to act on our anger, but we can respond to the situation, taking the anger into account. And sometimes we have to take account our limitation. So sometimes we might even do what's unskillful from one point of view, but because we know what our limitations are, we realize in the bigger picture, if I don't do this, then it's going to get even be worse. So that's, you kind of try to figure out the best, figure out what the situation is and try to figure out what the best response is, considering who you are, what the situation is. So, and then what is your intention? Is your intention to help you become less stressed or more open or more loving? To help other people become more open and loving or help someone else? If you give some space to our inner life, then we have the opportunity to at least know what our intentions are and choose our intention. And there's a world of difference between choosing our intention and letting the intention choose us.
There are some very extreme things going on in the world right now of massacres and extreme human suffering in many places around the world. And I think I myself feel guilty if I do not feel with other people in conditions like that, that I remove myself from them. all week, I've not known what to do about this. And because right now things are so extremely extreme.
Well, I think, again, this my response would be that we have to know what our limitations are also. And many different levels. And one level is our kind of the side of view, point of view of our shortcomings. And the other view, point of view is just a limitation. Being a human being is a limitation. And it's simply impossible to be even aware of all the suffering in the world, let alone read every newspaper to find out. I mean, what's going on is phenomenal. But we can make choices and say, well, I can't be aware of everything, but I think I'm going to take this particular thing and really get to know it well and do what I can. And so it's like Rwanda. That's going to be my thing for this next 6 months, even after it's left the newspapers. I'm going to really get to try to understand Rwanda and really be present and feel it and even do something for it, maybe send money or whatever. So you really kind of, you can make a choice and really limit yourself in that way. Rather than saying, you know, every possible war in the globe right now, if you know, it's... You know, it would just make you crazy. So that's one way, and is to make choices. The other response is that guilt is a guilt would have been an interesting thing to talk about in relation to fear. But guilt, from the Buddhist point of view, the way the Buddhists would like to define guilt involves a sense of self-hate and a personal aversion, and. The more positive aspect that's related to guilt in Buddhist psychology is what we call shame, or moral dread or remorse. So there's a way in which you can feel, oh, my response is not particularly good. I don't feel good about it. I feel some shame or some remorse about it, and that sense can be an inspiration to try to do better in the future. It can be forward directed. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be something that beats yourself up. But guilt is such a big part of our culture, and we're kind of taught to be guilty. And then it's very easy when there's so much going on, and we simply can't respond to it all. For myself, I think it's very important. It's been very important for me to realize that I have to make choices, very narrow choices, about how I'm going to respond to the suffering of the world. And it's very, very easy for me to feel drawn into wanting to do something about everything. And so I've made very clear choices in my life where my domain is. And I try to be aware of wider things and try to participate to some degree. But my response to suffering in the world is very much in the Dharma. It's teaching Dharma, practicing Dharma, is offering what I'm offering here. Mm-hmm. And some people will look at me and say, well, that's, you should be out, you know, in the field and, you know, helping the homeless or something. And maybe I should, but I feel that this is also a very important response. So anyway, this is my choice. So different people make different choices about how to respond to the suffering in the world. And I think we have to do that and keep our life a little bit focused and grounded. So we become a naturalist of our life, all aspects of our life, seeing how it unfolds. And just as we don't hold any views about whether we're a Buddha or not, or about our Buddhahood, so we don't regard any part of ourselves as an enemy, as a sinner or a villain. So that's kind of the opposite of seeing ourselves as Buddha, see ourselves maybe as sinners or whatever. So that's unnecessary also. Just as it's unnecessary to see ourselves as Buddhas, it's unnecessary to see ourselves or parts of ourselves as the enemy or as the villain. Rather, we try to see everything as part of a natural process, the natural process of life. And as soon as we get caught in the polarization, in the polarities of good and bad, then we tend to move from spirituality to what the Tibetan teacher Trungpa called spiritual materialism. And he defines spiritual materialism as working to achieve happiness or some spiritual state in a very simple-minded way, on the way to developing a particular form of ego. Using spirituality, spiritual practice, to cultivate and reinforce a strong sense of egoism or self-centeredness. That's become spiritual materialism. As naturalists, we meet everything with curiosity, granting it its right to be there. A naturalist neither represses, denies, or supports anything. A naturalist practices non-interfering presence and observation. Spirituality or mindfulness practice is not a battle. It's not a battlefield. And I would argue that mindfulness is a form of spiritual practice, which is a form of non-violence. And it's perhaps, to talk about observation or presence, maybe is a little bit too passive way of talking about being practicing with our emotional life, our fears. Maybe I like the word embracing. Just embrace everything. I would like to tell a fairy tale, a European fairy tale. There was a beautiful princess who had the bad fortune of being betrothed to a hideous monster, hideous serpent monster. So terrified, she sought counsel with a wise old witch. And the witch told the princess that she should go ahead with the marriage, but she should wear 10 white shifts on her wedding night. And that with each garment, when it came time to go to bed with the serpent, that as she took off each of the shifts, each of her gowns, she had to ask the serpent to take off one of his skins. And then after she'd taken off her 10 shifts or 10 gowns or whatever, that then she had to embrace the serpent. Well, she didn't like it so much, but she went ahead and took the advice and followed the advice of the old wise witch. And after taking off the last of her gowns, she saw this slimy, repulsive serpent was still there. So disgusted, she nevertheless had the wisdom to follow the instructions, and she embraced and kissed the serpent. And then, miraculously, the serpent transforms into her princely, beautiful princely lover, handsome princely lover. It's a nice story. Well, our lives are kind of like fairy tales. So first of all, very important is she recognizes and acknowledges the monster as her bridegroom, as being, you know, you don't have to see any parts of this fairy tale as being outside of one person, your own life. It's all aspects of yourself. So first she acknowledges the monster as her bridegroom, as what she has to wed or join herself to or embrace. So acceptance of that. And then she undresses the monster. And we undress, we take off the levels of our reactivity and levels of our life, our emotions. We're present for it and we investigate it. And you know, our life is built in all these levels and levels and levels. And you have to begin to kind of taking off the levels. We're really present for it for one level, and that dissolves and we're of the skin that's under it. The way we undress ourselves is being completely present for each skin as it is, for everything that presents itself. And then finally, when there's no more dresses or skins to be taken off, then we embrace it. So we too have to find a way to acknowledge, accept, undress, and embrace our difficult and painful sides. And the fears we have to these aspects of our lives is very much a strong source for their very power, motivating us to act on them and or around them, avoiding them. And the world of our fear, or the fearful world, our fear body, changes as we learn to face the depths with clear seeing and with presence. And we, all of us, have many layers. For example, many of us fear being hurt. Maybe that's a very primary kind of thing for a lot of people to feel. And maybe for many of us, that's kind of a very formative part of our characters, to fear being hurt. So then we adapt kind of maybe a defensive personality around that fear, so we don't have to be hurt. But the defensive personality itself can be threatened because we're holding this, you know, defensive personality. We're trying to be Mr. Cool. But, you know, the world isn't not so easy. It's not very easy to be Mr. Cool in this kind of world. So then we get fear around our defensive personality. We fear something might rock the boat. So there's another layer of fear. So then we make another structure, a more rigid structure, personality structure, in order to protect and hold in place the defensive mechanism so it's not jarred by anything. And then that can be, you know, and the more rigid you get in your personality structure, the more in some ways it can be crumbled, the more delicate it becomes. And the more we tend to make more and more solid, rigid structures, and the more we tend to become petrified. That's a good word. We fear any rupture in our personality structure. And so we add a new layer of rigidity on top of layer after layer. And these layers are layers of defensiveness, aggression, fear, shyness, all kinds of different ways that we add. And in a sense, with increasing rigidity, there's increased instability, in a sense, and also increasing fear, conscious or unconscious. There's a beautiful story in the Zen tradition of a painter in China, a master painter, one of the great painters of China. And the story is told that he painted a tiger. He was painting his tiger and painting his tiger, and it was a very realistic tiger. And he was painting it, and then at one point he stepped back to kind of look at his tiger that he'd been painting. And then he got frightened and ran away from his... And that's, you know, maybe describes, you know, our life. You know, we create the structure, and then we get frightened by our own very structure that we create. And we forget we've created it. I think that in modern parlance or modern psychology, there's a differentiation between fear, which has specific discernible objects to the fear. You can kind of see, it's very clear, and often it's good things to be afraid of. You're afraid of the car that's coming down the street at 60 miles an hour. And then differentiated with that kind of fear is anxiety, a different kind of fear. And anxiety is a situation where it's not always clear what the object of the fear is. It's somewhat vague, the object, or your attitude towards it is vague, and it's unconscious, and it's not clear. It's not really in the present, it's an imaginary. It's very much tied up in the imagination. It's in the future, or it's in the past, or, you know, it's a kind of maybe, what if. It's very much involved in the imagination, like the Zen artist. There's a rule that the further away in time the object of your fear is, the more of an opportunity is for your imagination to play on it. Kind of like a law of physics, in direct proportion. So if you have something that's going to happen like in 2 weeks or in a year or something, like an exam or something or whatever, remember that the longer time you have before it happens, the more your imagination has a chance to go wild. And if you remember that, maybe, you know, it's a little bit easier. But whether we call it fear or anxiety or dread, much of our life is based on and is motivated by apprehension and fear. Probably much more than most people realize. And I think that if you do some level of meditation, mindfulness practice, where you start paying attention to inner life, you'll begin becoming aware of on what level and degree apprehension and fear kind of not only is there, but runs our life. Fear is at the root of many, many different types of psychological suffering. Buddhism has many lists, and it has a list of the five great sufferings, five great fears. And they're an interesting list. There's fear of the loss of your livelihood, the fear of the loss of your reputation, the fear of unusual states of mind, the fear of death, and the fear of public speaking. And there's some of you might know better than I do, but there's some kind of survey of common fears in America. And I think public speaking is like the most common one. So you forgive me if I have my pangs of nervousness before I speak to you here. And there's the fear of pain. Oops. Should we stop and do something here? There's the fear of pain and the fear of insecurity and the fear of loss. And there's interesting fears like the fear of love and the fear of pleasure and the fear of knowledge. Some people don't want to know what's going on. Buddhist psychology distinguishes between two kinds of fear. There's many kinds, but Buddhism, you know, divides everything up in all kinds of ways. There's the fears that are rooted in desires and attachment. And fears, they say, arise. Buddhism says most fears arise because you're attached to things being a certain way, and you don't want it to change. And so change is very frightening for many people because you don't want it to change. And so you have some attachment. So that's one root for fear. Another form of fear is a kind of fear that comes as a consequence of leading an undesirable life, or an unvirtuous life, maybe is a better word to say. It's how you feel when you've really blown it, when you really have done something you feel bad about. Kind of not maybe not guilt, but shame, or you're worried somebody's going to find out, or you're worried what's going to happen, and the consequences. It can be related to guilt. And that kind of fear of the consequences, can be both negative and positive. It can be positive if we're forward-looking and seeing what we can learn from it and how maybe we can do better in the future. It can be negative in the sense that it can put the fear of punishment, the fear of hell in us. Buddhists in Asia have used the fear of nothing's everlasting in Buddhism, but the fear of long-term damnation as a very strong motivating force in Buddhist societies. And for people, maybe this is not a good thing to say, or fear thing to say, or maybe you disagree, but for people who don't have a lot of sophisticated understanding of themselves, often the motivating factor that keeps them living a moral life is the fear of ending up in hell. And then theologians and community leaders have reinforced that fear by talking about it. And, you know, just so there's been great, you know, Buddhists are giving great sermons on all the hells that you'll go to and what will happen to you, and in order to, you know, encourage people to be good, not to disrupt society. You're not going to hear that kind of talk from me. I think we're more sophisticated. We'll find we don't need that kind of fear in order to live virtuous lives. And just as with other emotions, fear is often involved in complicated patterns and layers and associations with a lot of other emotions. Fear is often not so simple event. Fear is often mixed with anger, or fear can cover anger, or sometimes anger covers fear. It's wonderful the way emotions cover other emotions. Arrogance sometimes is a cover for insecurity. Fear in its very nature involves some kind of movement of avoidance. You want something you want to avoid. So just as the princess starts with the outer skin of the monster, in mindfulness practice, we start by getting to know well the manifest emotions. We don't psychoanalyze or try to figure out, you know, what all the layers are and what's at the root. We simply take what's given, what's presented to us as the manifest experience, and we see if we can have an uncomplicated relationship with what's presented to us. What's presented to us might have many layers and be very complicated, but often what's kind of in the surface, what's predominant maybe, is anger or fear or despair or joy or happiness or love, something that's kind of what presents itself. Our job as mindfulness practitioners is to meet directly in an uncomplicated way what's in front of us. And as I said to the earlier group tonight, you know, and many of you know that I talk about the many generations of reactivity that we have to our experience. That we're afraid of something, and then we're afraid of our fear, and then we're angry with ourselves because we're afraid of our fear, and then we're angry with ourselves being angry again, and then we're despairing because it's gotten so complicated again. And then, you know, we feel guilty because, you know, I'm a meditation teacher, I should know better, and so you feel guilty, and then you feel shame, you don't make sure no one finds out, and then you're shy, and then, and how many generations, you know, we live our life in the 14th, 15th generation, maybe not the 114th generation, away from the primary thing. There's all this reactivity. Our task in mindfulness practice is not to kind of be upset with ourselves because we're at the 114th generation, but rather take the 114th generation and wake up there, accept that. Don't complicate it anymore. At some point, we can have an uncomplicated direct relationship with what's presented, what's manifest. There's a lot of benefits to doing mindfulness practice, and they're different than maybe what some people expect. The chief executive of a large company was greatly admired for his energy and drive, but he suffered from one embarrassing weakness. Each time he entered the president's office to make his weekly report, he would wet his pants. The kindly president advised him to see a urologist at company expense. But when he appeared before the president the following week, his pants were wet again. "Didn't you see the urologist?" asked the president. "No. He was out. I saw the psychiatrist instead, and I'm cured," the executive replied. I no longer feel embarrassed. So we try not to be troubled by our fear. Start by not being troubled by our fear. We don't try by getting rid of our fear, because that's getting involved in idealism. But we try to get to know our fear really well, explore it, sense it, become a connoisseur, so we're not troubled by it. Certainly we don't want to deny it. That only strengthens it. And much of our culture is made up of denying our pain and our fears. The Buddha, before he became a Buddha, and probably after also, he had a practice of whenever there was a fear arose in him, he would stop whatever he was doing so that he could attend to the fear. Isn't that a nice practice? So whenever you feel any kind of pang of apprehension or anything, you stop and pay attention to it. And there was lots of opportunity to get afraid in the old days, in the time of Buddha, because the monks would wander and meditate in the forest, in the jungles, where there were all these wonderful tigers and snakes. And often the Buddha would send his monks into these jungles, and they'd come running back to him and say they were afraid. One of the antidotal practices that he taught them, and this first time that the Buddha taught loving kindness meditation, was as an antidote to fear. So sometimes if you find it very difficult to be present for fear in a mindful way, exploring it, you might just switch and do loving kindness for a while as a way of finding some spaciousness and some calm. And then when you find that, you can come back and investigate the fear. And often in the old days, people would intentionally go into places where fear would be stimulated so they can deal with their fear. And whereas in the old days they would go into the jungles, for us, we should probably have our meditation center in East Palo Alto. It would serve us well. And them probably also.
I think we ought to stop right there.
Because it's getting late, or because you didn't like what I said?
No, yes.
You didn't like what I said?
Well, I just think that has a profound implication to what was raised before.
Mm-hmm. Please. I realized when I said that that there might be opening and they can.
Profoundly influenced by what happens on two sides of the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I made up my mind what I wanted to do about that.
Mm-hmm. Or what's happening so close by. And on one hand, I think it'd be nice to open up a center there because I think that this kind of practice is very useful for people and to offer some kind of other way. On the other hand, it's also very presumptuous for me to think that and to think that I have anything to offer. But to impose myself, and there's a big difference between imposing yourself on people, and our middle class practice here, and being invited in. So I prefer to be invited in terms of this kind of practice that I'm doing. And I listen for invitations, eagerly waiting for invitations. I waited 10 years for an invitation to go to a prison. I put it out that I was interested in going to a prison. And it took 10 years before the universe responded. Should I continue a little bit more?
Yes.
we can talk more about this. This is a good thing to talk about. So, in particular, with fear, it's very useful to develop the skill of labeling our fear, to recognize when it arises. Stop, in a sense, for it, and label it, give it a name. Labeling it is a way of not being caught by it so fully. And then, as many of you know, grounding the fear in the body. If you can experience the fear in your body, if you experience any emotions at all in your body, it's a lot easier to be present for it and not be overwhelmed by it. There's a way in which you can allow the body to become the container. The body is the container anyway. We tend to be so much in our head, we forget about it. We're lost in it. The body is the container for our life, for the unfolding of our life. If we can experience these things happening with this wonderful, rich, organic container, that it's contained in this wonderful way, then it's a lot safer to feel what's going on. In meditation practice or mindfulness practice, or maybe in any spiritual life, I hope, we're learning to replace fear with trust. Not so much trust as an ideal, I'll try to trust, but rather by getting to know the fear really well, you can learn that it's trustable. It's okay to experience the fear. A lot of people have fear of fear, and a tremendous reactivity to fear and aversion to fear. If you can simply allow it to be okay to experience fear, you develop a certain kind of trust. Life is trustable enough for me to experience my fear. That's a lot different than saying, well, I'm going to try to trust now. Usually you get to know the fear really well, then it becomes clear you can trust the experience. And I think so many of us have been convinced for many different reasons, by our society, by our own experiences in life, by our own logic, that we cannot trust our own natural state of being. And in a sense, it's a result of being turned away from ourselves over and over again, to turning away from ourselves. We are taught to distrust ourselves. And as we discover our fears, as we learn to be present for our sense of unworthiness, for a sense of shame, for a sense of all aspects of who we are, without destroying it, without trying to control them, but rather by going into it, giving it room, we can begin seeing how all this stuff works, and how we create a reality, how we create our emotional life and our reactions. And we learn to trust deeper and deeper. As we take off the layers of the monster, the skins of the monster, we're also expanding our trust into the wider and wider circles of who we are. And the process of awakening, the process of enlightenment, can be understood as widening ever-widening development of ever-widening circles of trust, finding that you can trust ever wider ways. And enlightenment itself is when the trust is so wide it no longer has any boundaries at all. It's become boundless. You can expect to confront fear if you follow a spiritual practice. And not only is there the fears of our own neurosis and anxieties, but there's also spiritual practice itself will challenge every single personality's ego structure that we've built to try to prove who we are or prove ourselves or defend ourselves or be someone. Awareness practice will challenge all of that. Because awareness practice doesn't need any of it. It all is the folds and creases. Awareness, with enough trust, awareness needs nothing. Awareness can just be boundless and open. And it can be very frightening to begin to experience that, or to even to be start hinting that's a possibility. Because, for many reasons. And that fear becomes a very important door. And this inability, well, there's this inability to face the absence of an ego that is often expressed as fear or results in fear. How much do we avoid being alone? Ultimately, I think we have to learn to be in some radical way completely alone. Finally, so we're not even present for ourselves. It's said that one way to reduce fear in our life is to practice lowering the flag of conceit. The more you develop conceit, and the more you kind of develop a strong sense of I, and arrogance, and conceit, and a strong sense of rigid sense of who you are, the more you'll be afraid. The more you kind of create the possibilities to be threatened. So if you practice kind of letting go of conceit, you'll then indirectly be letting go of your potential to be afraid. Well, maybe I'll just end with now that those people who learn to trust life, trust being aware, trust being alive without any props and crutches and views and opinions, that those people are known in the Buddhist traditions as being dispellers of fear in others. That they give the gift of fearlessness. And one of the things, both your responses, you know, in terms of what we can do, there's many things we should do, but one of the beautiful things that we can do is we can offer our fearlessness. And that can be a profound gift that is often forgotten when we're busy giving food and housing and many things that are really essential. But there's other things that we can give, that can be given. Give the gift of fearlessness. So in developing the capacity to be fearless, we don't just do it for ourselves, but we also do it for others. So then I'll really end with a quote. I am a monk myself, and the one question I really wanted to ask was, what is a monk? Well, I finally did. I went and talked to this other monk. But for an answer, I got a most peculiar question. Do you mean in the daytime or at night? Now, what could that mean? When I didn't answer, he picked up again. A monk, like everyone else, is a creature of contraction and expansion. During the day, he is contracted, behind his cloister walls, dressed in a habit like all the others, doing the routine things you expect a monk to do. At night, he expands. The walls cannot contain him. He moves throughout the world, and he touches the stars. Ah, I thought, poetry. To bring him down to earth, I began to ask, Well, during the day, in his real body, wait, he said. That's the difference between us and you. You people regularly assume that the contracted state of the real body, that the contracted state is the real body. It is real in a sense. But here we tend to start from the other end, the expanded state. The daytime state we refer to the body of fear. And whereas you tend to judge a monk by his decorum during the day, we tend to measure a monk by the number of persons he touches at night and the number of stars. So let's sit quietly for about a minute or two together.